This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Michael Winterbottom has made 10 feature films in less than 10 years that on the surface seem to have very little in common. They include the Balkan war drama Welcome to Sarajevo, adaptations of the Thomas Hardy novels Jude the Obscure and The Mayor of Casterbridge, also Wonderland, a stark portrayal of contemporary life in London, and last year's film 24-Hour Party People, about the club scene in Manchester in the 80s. His latest film, In This World, picks up on perhaps the only constant theme throughout his work, an interest in the intersection between fiction and nonfiction, documentary and feature film. It's an unusually realistic depiction of two young Afghani refugees living in Pakistan who try to escape overland to England. The young men, Jamal and his cousin Anaitullah, are played by non-actors who are real-life refugees from Afghanistan, and their grueling and often bewildering journey is filmed as if it were a documentary. I asked Michael Winterbottom what compelled him to make a movie about the plight of refugees.
I think the first motivation was really the attitude to immigrants in Europe generally, and in particular in Britain. In the last election, that both parties, the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, were very, very hostile to refugees or economic migrants. In fact, economic migrant became a term of abuse that clearly they shouldn't be here. And generally in Europe, you know, there's this idea of fortress Europe, of let's keep out people from outside Europe, let's try and protect European culture from outside influences.
I'd like to talk about this research trip that you and your screenwriter, Tony Grassoni, took to trace the route that the film follows from Peshawar to Istanbul and on to London. Your departure was planned for September 12th, 2001, originally. So on September 11th, what was your conversation with Tony Grassoni like?
Well, I think, you know, we'd already decided by that stage that we would focus on Afghan refugees and we would start in Peshawar. And then, obviously, September 11th happened. And initially, I think, you know, first of all, you know, Tony was a little bit worried, was it safe? And then we obviously had the kind of perhaps more serious worry about would what was happening in Afghanistan cloud the issue about refugees and somehow become a distraction to the film. But obviously, you know, the other factor about the bombing campaign in Afghanistan that followed September 11th was that it created a whole new wave of refugees. So when we arrived in Peshawar, you know, we didn't know kind of what reception we would get. And what we found was that everyone there, whether Afghan or Pakistani, everyone there was against the bombing campaign in Afghanistan. Everyone was against kind of Western policy. Most of the people there were supporters of the Taliban, because really Peshawar and that part of Pakistan was the home of the Taliban and where the Taliban had kind of begun. In fact, we went to the madrasa where Mullah Omar had been educated and talked to the guy who ran it, who was explaining that there were no students at the madrasa at the time because they were all in Afghanistan fighting on the side of the Taliban. And yet, despite the fact that politically everyone was very hostile, at a personal level, everyone was incredibly hospitable, and we found that there were no problems being there, were no problems working with Pakistani people or Afghan people, and that everyone was incredibly friendly.
While you were traveling along this route, did people think you were spies, the British Foreign Service?
I don't think so. I don't think we looked much like spies, to be honest. I mean, on the first trip, Tony and I were by ourselves, and we were traveling with just a little video camera, but traveling as tourists. And really the kind of only problem we had, we were traveling across the desert in Pakistan towards the Iranian border, and we were in the back of a pickup truck, and we got to an army checkpoint and we were stopped, and the soldier who was in charge of the checkpoint kind of kept sort of looking in Tony's bag and trying to find different things, and we didn't know what was going on. We were there for a couple of hours, and then about five armoured personnel carriers turned up with about another 40 soldiers, and we had no idea whether they were being arrested or what. So, and he kept sort of looking at little gadgets that Tony had. So in the end, I told Tony to give him a gadget. You know, it didn't matter what it was, just give him something. And so Tony gave it to him, and suddenly he was very pleased and happy. And we were then escorted by these soldiers for about the next sort of hour and a half across the desert. And then we got to the next checkpoint, and suddenly they let us go. And we never knew what that was about and what it was for. It was simply kind of one of those kind of bizarre experiences that happen when you're in a different culture. So we then included that kind of incident within the film and had the same sort of thing happen to Anaitullah and Jamal in the film.
I'd like to talk about the making of this film, because it's interesting in the way that it's a feature film, but it has the feel of a documentary. There's an occasional voiceover that sounds like the BBC. They're cut away to maps and titles for the locations, the cities that the boys travel through. Why did you use those documentary trappings? And you end up with a kind of hybrid, an interesting hybrid of fact and fiction.
I think really the approach then was to try and make the film as simply as possible, to try and make the film simply a record of a journey, and a journey that Annetta and Jamal are making. And any information we gave in the voiceover is really simply to give briefly and as simply as possible the kind of background to the story, where they are, the context of the camp, who's in the camp, and so on. So really the film is a fiction in the sense that we organized the journey for Jamal and Ayatollah. We looked for two people to make that journey. They weren't making that journey anyway. And various incidents along the way were organized by us. But it's also, in a sense, a record of the journey they made. Jamal and Ayatollah are not speaking lines of dialogue. They're not pretending to be a character, in a sense. They're simply reacting to events around them. So in some ways, the film, the idea was to make the film as simple as possible so we could record that journey. And in a lot of ways, most days we sort of said, okay, get in the back of the pickup truck, we're going to drive to wherever the next town was, and we simply recorded what happened along the way. Of course, there are some incidents which are more fiction, which are more organized than that, because, for instance, when they get in the container ship to go to Italy.
You're talking about a scene in the film in which the boys and number of other refugees are in a freight container, and they travel from Turkey to Italy. They become afraid. They're afraid of they're not getting enough oxygen. It's a scary situation.
Yeah, I mean, there was two reasons we really wanted to use that sequence. One was that one of the stories that really made me want to make the film was there was a container that arrived at Dover in England with, I think it was 48 Chinese immigrants on it, and 46 of them were dead. Only two of them survived. And that obviously, because of the nature of that tragedy, it generated a lot of interest and publicity about the sort of journeys people make. But also, when we were filming in Italy with Jamal and Ayatollah, that particular month, I think there was something like 3,000 immigrants landed on the Italian coastline from Albania or Turkey. And there was an Italian minister at the time, Umberto Bossi, who was the leader of the Northern League, who said basically it was the Italian Navy's duty to sink any ship that was arriving with refugees. And that, so I wanted to, so these things, all the kind of events in the film were kind of inspired by kind of real stories. And in fact, most of the things in the film are far less kind of extreme or dramatic than a lot of stories that get reported.
For the frightening moments in the film, the freight container scene, and also a scene in which the boys and their guides, their smugglers, are shot at by a patrol during a blizzard as they're crossing the Kurdish mountains from Iran into Turkey, the filming is as if in a nightmare. It's very evocative. It's blurry. It's as if one of them just happened to have a camera and had it on the whole time. It seems just a blur of fear and smothering and stealth. How did you decide to film this part of the story?
Well, basically the film was always the same, which was to film it as simply as possible. We had one small camera, PD-150. It's like the size of a normal kind of, domestic camera. We put radio mics on the actors so that there were no microphones visible. And on set, there was simply a cameraman and a sound recordist and myself. So the idea was like really to have the minimum amount of equipment and the minimum technical process coming between us and the story. So, when it was dark, we simply shot with whatever light was available. So in the case of, crossing the mountains, from the very beginning, we knew that obviously if you were smuggling across the mountain, you wouldn't have big torches with you lighting the way. And that obviously up a mountain, there is no light there apart from whatever light you gain from the stars. So we shot on a tiny camera with night vision and simply, recorded, we told them to hike up the mountain and hike back down again. And we walked with them and filmed it happening. And that was really the approach. All the way, the filming was very, very simple, and hopefully, if it works in terms of atmosphere and so on, it's because gradually, bit by bit, you've got to know those people. You're traveling on that journey with them. And therefore, you're sort of hoping they survive and hoping they succeed in the and you're with them in that journey. And obviously, you know, one of the most frightening things is to not know what's happening. And the experience, obviously, of refugees is they never really know what's happening. They're simply told to do things, and they have to hope that those things are going to work out for them.
Now, you cast non-actors that you found in Peshawar for the film, the two boys, and the other actors in the film. How did you find them? How do you cast?
Well, with the two main characters, there were 1 million refugees, so it was the problem was like how to select 2 out of 1 million, and really it was a bit potluck. We knew we wanted 2 young males because they're the people who are on the whole make this journey, and we simply kind of went to the camps, went to the markets where Afghan people work and so on, and I think a casting director went out and recruited maybe like 200 people. And then I met them, and we talked to them, and we played games and so on. But it was really a bit potluck. We were looking for people who we thought would survive the journey. We were looking for people we thought would get on with each other and would get on with us. And we were looking for people who would want to go back, because we didn't want to make this film as a kind of lottery of, like, these two people, you get to be refugees in Britain. We wanted it to be a job where people would perhaps hopefully find it interesting and enjoyable and also make some money. And so those were the criteria.
My guest is filmmaker Michael Winterbottom. His new film is In This World. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's continue our interview with filmmaker Michael Winterbottom. His new film is In This World. It follows the journey of 2 Afghani refugees as they try to get from Pakistan to London. In this scene from the film, one of the boys, Jamal, is in a refugee camp in France. A fellow refugee is trying to befriend him.
What's the matter? You smoke cigarettes?
No.
Come sit.
Why?
I want to talk to you.
Why?
What? How old are you?
Me?
Yes, how old are you?
I'm 16.
You're 16?
Yeah.
You're by yourself?
Me?
Yeah.
Now, you shot the film in Pakistan, Iran, and Turkey only, really not very long after September 11th. What kind of hoops did you have to go through, and what kind of complications came up filming under such politically sensitive and dangerous circumstances? And I couldn't help but think your insurance must have been through the roof, right?
Yeah, I think the insurance was the biggest cost on the whole film, and we had to have like insurance about, you know, being flown out of situations, and kidnap insurance and all this sort of nonsense. You know, the first thing was that we said, okay, we didn't tell them what we were filming. We told them we were filming a documentary about the ancient Silk Route, and we were following that route to show the way in which that differed from present day. Even so, in Turkey, they refused to allow us to film there. So in Turkey, we had to pretend to be tourists, and we all went in one by one and then gradually met up again afterwards. In Pakistan, we said we were doing this kind of semi-documentary filming about the Silk Route. Even so, we were delayed for about a week. It was at a time when Daniel Pearl had been kidnapped, and they suggested that that was the reason why they weren't allowing us in, that it was for our security. But it was never really clear, you know, what the motive was. But so we finally got in there. But
So all of these complications involved visas.
Yeah, absolutely. And the hardest thing, obviously, by far, was getting visas for 2 refugees. You know, Jamal and Anaitullah are genuine refugees. They had no papers. They had no paperwork. And, you know, initially, the British embassy was like, we're in no way we're going to give these 2 people visas. We don't want them in our country. And eventually, we sort of bombarded them with letters from Britain and all sorts of stuff. And eventually, after months, they said yes. The Pakistan government said they wouldn't give them a visa to come back. And that was really the biggest complication, because as refugees, you know, there's no particular reason why Pakistan should let them back once they're in Britain. On the other hand, you know, Jamal had been born in a refugee camp, had never been outside Pakistan, and Anaitullah had been there since he was 10 or 11. So this was their home, and we had to find a way of getting them back. And that was really the biggest complication. And that was the complication all along. Each time we crossed the border, there was some issue about these people are from Afghanistan, therefore they shouldn't be in our country, therefore their papers must be illegal.
How do you solve that catch-22?
It was complicated. I mean, we sort of thought about it a lot. And in the end, we decided the best thing was to try and get the papers to be as legitimate as possible. Now, that actually involved us smuggling them from Pakistan into Afghanistan and taking them up to Kabul and got them a passport. We smuggled them back into Pakistan. So by that stage, we had a passport, and we used that passport. And eventually, after a lot of struggle, we got the visa to England on the basis of that. But as I say, we couldn't get the visa from the Pakistan government to allow them back in, a sort of re-entry visa to Pakistan. So, and we were stuck, and we'd like been doing some filming, and we really had like a week where we were hanging around, didn't know what to do. And eventually we asked our Pakistan fixer, who also played the fixer in the film, the people smuggler in the film, we asked him to just get us a visa. We didn't care how we got it, just get us a visa. And so a couple of days later, we turned up, and there were now visas in the passport. So great, we can set off. And we traveled across, filming through the sort of deserts of north of Pakistan, and arrived at Taftan, which is the border between Pakistan and Iran. We were getting a lot of hassle from the military intelligence guy there, who kept saying we weren't allowed to film because it was the border, and we're not allowed to film near the border. And we had all these hassles the whole time. We had, kept having to sneak off and film and, you know, do decoys so he would follow someone else and we'd film ourselves and so on. And the day before we were due to cross into Iran, our fixer said he had to leave because he didn't want to get into trouble. He didn't want to be there when we crossed the border. So we're like, okay, well, that seems fair enough. So he left. And then the next morning, we arrived at the border. And as soon as we got there, the military intelligence guy was there. And he straight away went to Jamal and Ayatollah and opened their passports, looked at their visas and said they were false. And it turned out that our fixer had actually told him they were false visas. And we were like, oh, God, you know, we're completely stuffed now. We won't be able to get them out of the country. This is the end of it. But it turned out, you know, after sort of an hour or so of negotiations, that what was required was some cash. And so we paid some cash and we got across the border.
Was that the only time cash was required?
Yeah, that was actually. I mean, Iran, you know, Iran was actually the easiest country we had to film in. The permissions side was the easiest. We had a lot of cooperation. And for instance, there's a scene in Iran where there's a checkpoint and the soldier gets on the bus and searches the bus and finds that Jamal and Ayatollah are refugees and takes them off. And all that, you know, was we were arriving at a real checkpoint and our fixer went up to ask them if it was all right to film there. And the commander of the checkpoint said, yes, it's fine, as long as I can be the soldier who gets on the bus. And so he
he
then
wanted
did it
to
all
be
for,
in the film.
Yeah. And then he did it all for real. And yeah, after, you know, it was fine. It was really simple to film and he did it really well. And at the end of the sequence was he was driving the Ayatollah and Jamal off into the desert as though he was like taking them back to the border. And he drove them off in his vehicle with a huge great gun on the back into this creek. And when he came back, he said that actually when he got into the creek, there was a whole bunch of Afghan refugees really hiding there. And, you know, normally he would arrest them. But as he'd been filming with us that day, he'd let them off.
Now, after you finished the film, Jamal went back to Pakistan and then he traveled back to the UK and he claimed asylum. And we're not talking about the film anymore. This was his life, real life. How did he get there? And did you have any role in that? Did you even know?
No, not at all. I mean, basically, we'd finished filming and Jamal had gone home. And about 2 months later, we got a phone call and he was already in Britain and he was already claiming asylum. And we didn't know how he traveled there at all. And I think, you know, I don't think he came the way that he came in the film. But I think whatever route you take, if you're 15 years old, which I think is what Jamal was at that time, if you're leaving everything you know behind, you're leaving the country you're born, all the family you have there, all the friends you have there, you're leaving your culture behind. You know, and taking that chance, you know, for the possibility of having a better life, for the possibility of a better future, then obviously it's an incredibly brave thing to do and something which emotionally is very complicated. So, you know, from our point of view, you know, we were kind of really surprised and obviously hope that it works out for Jamal and hope that he's happy. But you know, these things are not easy. It's not clearly the case that it's better to be in London than it is to be in Pakistan. And his application for asylum was refused, in fact. You know, he hasn't been categorized as a refugee. He's had his application refused, but because he's a minor, he's allowed to stay in Britain until he's 18, and then he'll be sent back, or he could appeal and try and win an appeal.
What's he doing?
He's at school. He's at school. So, you know, he's being put into a foster family in London and he's at school. You know, I think, you know, and he seems happy, you know, we see him quite often and he seems kind of happy and surviving. But clearly, for someone that age to have made such a big, you know, transition, that's, you know, it's very, very hard. And when we were originally doing the filming, Jamal started off being very self-confident and cocky. He's very bright and clever. But as we got further and further away from Pakistan and the kind of culture he recognized, you know, it seemed like he was finding it harder and harder and sort of seemed quite sort of, you know, we were quite worried at the time that, you know, whether he was okay and whether he was surviving it and enjoying it or not. So it was quite strange that, you know, to sort of see him back again, having been worried about whether he was going to be okay for a few weeks, to see him having made that journey back and doing it on a basis where, you know, he never knows really whether he'll get back or not.
I can't help but thinking that Jamal could not have been very sophisticated and known exactly what he was getting into when he started with this film and this journey, and also that he must have had some hopes or gotten the hope or the desire, the vision to emigrate once he got caught up in it.
I think that's a complicated question. I think one thing that I became aware of making the film is that if you go to a place like Peshawar, people there are much more aware of our culture, much more aware of us than we are of them. I think one of the problems in the world is that people in the rich countries, people in developed countries, try and ignore what's going on in the rest of the world because we don't like to think about it. Whereas people in developing countries do have access to a lot of, you know, material about us and are more interested. So, you know, you go to Pakistan, obviously a lot of people speak English in Pakistan because of the cultural kind of connections. But there's also, you know, cables available, or satellites available, so people see, you know, it's possible to see TV programs from America or Europe. There's, you know, mobile phones work so you can be in contact. There's the internet so you can get information from the internet. You know, Peshawar is not in a different world to ours. It's in the same world as ours. And people like Jamal, you know, Jamal's a very bright kid, you know, spoke about four different languages, has, you know, in lots of ways, probably a much more sophisticated, mature version of the world than a child the same age would have in America or Britain. And I think, I don't know really what was going on in Jamal's head, and I don't know whether he, when he came to England, he was inspired to come back, or whether when he got back to Peshawar as a refugee, there were other factors that forced him to think he should come back. But certainly I think it's wrong to think that the version of the world that refugees have is somehow less sophisticated than the version of the world that we have.
Filmmaker Michael Winterbottom. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's get back to our interview with director and screenwriter Michael Winterbottom. His new film, In This World, is about two refugees as they flee Pakistan for London. Winterbottom's other movies include Welcome to Sarajevo, Wonderland, and 24-Hour Party People. I wanted to talk about 24-Hour Party People. It's about the 1980s rave music and club scene in Manchester, and it's told through the eyes of Tony Wilson, who was founder of Factory Records. He was a real raconteur, kind of a big TV personality. Did you watch him on television?
I did. I grew up near to Manchester, so as a child I'd see Tony Wilson doing, you know, crazy sort of local news stunts like hang gliding down mountains or, you know, talking to ducks or whatever. Did a lot of sort of novelty items on the local TV news, and it was very kind of weird, kind of gradually realizing that he was also the same person who was running Factory Records, who had a lot of great bands signed to them, and then opening the Hacienda Club. There was this kind of very strange double life of sort of the daytime NAF TV celebrity and the nighttime kind of music business guy, and that was kind of really what drew me to the idea of making the film. I mean, obviously, it was great to make a film about Manchester. It's a great city, and it's kind of the city that I kind of grew up with. It was also, you know, kind of great to make a film about that music, which is the brilliant music, and the film goes from 76 and punk music all the way through to 92. So it had a big range of fantastic music in it.
Was that a music scene you were personally immersed in?
I was around, you know, sort of punk was like the first music that, as a sort of teenager, was like the first new wave of music for me, and that certainly kind of was music I loved. And Factory, although Factory Records came after punk, Factory was very much inspired by punk. The kind of approach to the music was the same as punk, which is basically, you know, the attitude was like anyone should be allowed to do whatever they want to do. You know, the record company shouldn't tell artists what to do. Artists should be free to do what they want, and if they want to walk away, they can do. So there's this kind of incredibly chaotic attitude born out of a kind of desire to be sort of free and anarchic. And that was the sort of spirit that was made it sort of really attractive to make. And, you know, and for all their ups and downs, what I liked about it was that, you know, even though Factory went bankrupt and everything was lost, that sense that they didn't really care, you know, that in the film, and I think to a certain extent in reality, you know, Tony Wilson is like, you know, he doesn't care about whether he makes money or not, doesn't care about the ups and downs. He still is optimistic, still believes that, you know, there'll be the next wave coming and he'll be riding it. And so I like that sense of a kind of hero who learns nothing but remains kind of defiantly optimistic.
Well, Steve Coogan, he's a British comedian and he and actor, and he plays the role of Tony Wilson, who narrates the film and also talks directly to the camera. And it Coogan has great facility with language in this part. Let's play a clip from the film. Here's Steve Coogan as Tony Wilson.
The history of popular music is like a double helix, okay? That's two waves that intertwine. So one wave goes like this, the other one goes like that. So you've got two waves doing that, okay? Like one like that, one like that. Basically, when one musical movement's in the descendant, another one is in the ascendant. Right now, we're in a kind of a crisscross, a kind of hiatus. But the two guys that are going to be on the crest of the next wave are Paul and Sean Ryder. This is a true incident, a bit like the hang gliding, which, remember, works on two levels. This takes place in 1980, when Sean and Paul put rat poison into some bread and fed it to 3,000 pigeons.
That's
obviously, it's a reconstruction. No pigeons were harmed in the making of this film. Although there are those that say they're pests. Rats with wings.
Steve Coogan as the TV personality and record producer Tony Wilson in the film 24-Hour Party People. What was it like to work with Coogan, and did he improvise a lot in that part?
It was brilliant working with Steve. I mean, you know, it's like, I think it was one of the most enjoyable experiences I've had. When we first had the idea to make the film, it was already like the very first conversation we had about it, it was already that, and Steve Coogan must play Tony Wilson. And from the very beginning, it was like, if Steve doesn't play it, I don't really want to do it. Because, you know, Steve, like Tony's from Manchester, he has a very similar kind of relationship to Manchester, because Manchester's a relatively small city, and both of them are quite famous within that city. But in Manchester, if you're famous, you don't get a lot of praise, you get a lot of attacks and abuse and slagging offs, really. And so they were both kind of used to that idea, and yeah, they both kind of grew up in a sort of the same sort of Catholic, you know, society, went to the same sort of schools, and I really felt that Steve would understand and be able to kind of make the character of Tony Wilson work. And so it was fantastic. And, you know, there was a script, and we worked on the script with Steve. Frank Contraboyce wrote the script. I worked a lot, and it was a brilliant script.
Well, there's a great scene of Tony Wilson's wife having sex with someone in the bathroom of the dance club. She's getting back at him for his sleeping around. And the whole scene seems just wonderfully comedic and out of control. What was filming it like that?
Well, I mean, when we started off researching the film, we sort of, first of all, talked to Tony and then to lots of other people, and everyone had anecdotes about what was happening. And basically, all the anecdotes were about how crazy and stupid everything was. Basically, everyone did the kind of, you know, stuff that was made no sense at all, but they did it for the best of reasons. And so we wanted to celebrate all that. And obviously, because we're using real music, we were also, you know, all the characters in the film were real people. So we then had to try and get their permission, and often get their permission to show them, you know, being incredibly stupid. So we sent the script to everyone, and, you know, in the case of that particular sequence of the film, in the original script that Frank wrote, he had Tony's ex-wife sleeping with Vinnie Riley. And so we met up with Lindsay, and she said, actually, it wasn't Vinnie Riley. I never slept with Vinnie Riley. It was Howard Devoto. So we said, okay, and Frank changed the scene to sleeping with Howard Devoto, and then we sent the script to Howard Devoto. And Howard Devoto had a couple of changes he wanted to make about the Buzzcocks. He was like the original member of the Buzzcocks. But then he also said, you know, we said to everyone, you know, it'd be great if you came down to set, it'd be great if you were in the film. And Howard Devoto kind of wrote back, said, you know, he'd love to be in the film. And what he would like to be is a toilet attendant when Lindsay is actually having sex with the fictional Howard Devoto in the film. And he would like to sort of say that he didn't really remember it happening like that. So we thought that was good. That was like in the spirit of the film. So we shot the sequence with Shirley, who played Lindsay, you know, having sex with the Howard Devoto character in the toilets. And then we sort of panned away and saw Howard cleaning the sinks. And Howard turns to the camera and says, you know, I don't remember it happening like this. And so we thought that was good. It was made clear it wasn't exactly true, but it was sort of true. And then when we had the rough cut of the film, we showed the film to Lindsay. And of course, you know, Lindsay, being Tony's ex-wife, was not fantastically happy about the project from the word go. You know, she was like, you know, she didn't really want to be party to a film celebrating Tony because she had a lot of bad thoughts about him. But
it's getting very, very complicated.
Anyway, Lindsay saw the sequence of the film, and she said she didn't want that scene to be in the film because, for a start, she didn't have sex in the toilets. It was in a hotel bedroom somewhere. And secondly, how Devoto dressed up as a toilet attendant looked really stupid. And she didn't want people thinking that she'd had sex with someone who looked that stupid. So we then had to do another voiceover kind of saying again, actually, you know, I can't remember what it said, but it was some disclaimer pointing out again that it wasn't really true. And so eventually we managed to get her to agree. But for a long time, she was going to sue us for that scene. So the film was great fun to make, but it was also complicated because you are dealing with real people's lives and people, you know, and we were dealing with versions of their lives that were not necessarily strictly speaking true, but were perhaps true to the spirit of what had happened. So
complicated just making the movie, but imagine what it was like to live then.
Yeah, exactly. But on the other hand, although it's complicated, we also had a lot of fun making the movie, and I think all the actors in the film had a great time pretending to be in bands, and I think everyone who was acting the film by the end of it decided it would be much more fun to be in a band than it would be to be an actor.
This film seems so different from many of your other films about more political issues, but really your films are all very different from each other. Does that just happen as you follow your interest, or are you conscious to follow different threads, very different passions?
From my point of view, making a film, obviously, once you've made one type of film, say that's a period film based on a book, or I made a film called Jude based on a Thomas Hardy novel, the idea of them making another film based on a Victorian novel is very boring. It's like there's more interest in finding something else which seems fresh and new. So there isn't really a conscious plan of like, let's do something different. But I just think naturally it's like it's more interesting to work in a new area and to try and find something which seems to pose new problems.
Well, Michael Winterbottom, thank you so much for talking today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Michael Winterbottom's new film is In This World.